This episode of the Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico podcast is brought to you by Spectacle Eyewear. Now, if you've been watching any episodes of this podcast on our YouTube channel, you might have noticed I've been wearing some pretty cool specs lately. Well, you know where I get them? Spectacle Eyewear, 505 Tremont Street, Boston, Massachusetts. Their phone number is 617-542-9600. Head down to Spectacle. Go visit our friend Paul. You'll get yourself some cool specs. Time to rock. Welcome to Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. We started you off today with a great tune from Blame It on Whitman. Love that song, Marigold, that came out last April on the Bait EP, one of the coolest releases last year. If you want to see Blame It on Whitman live, this is your chance. They are opening for Chinese Telephones March 20th at Faces in Malden, Massachusetts. I haven't been there yet, but people keep telling me it's one of the coolest new venues around the Boston area. And Blame It on Whitman is one of the coolest bands in the Boston scene. So please, March 20th, Faces, Malden, Massachusetts. Check it out. All right. Now, if anyone knows about cool bands and what's happening in the Boston music scene, it's Miss Lynn and Blowfish from Boston Groupie News, and you guessed it. They are here today on the show to talk about the Boston music scene, which they have been covering since the mid-70s. We had a wonderful conversation, so stick around. We're going to play that for you shortly. Being the big vinyl lover that I am, I'm proud to tell you about Joe's Albums in their two locations. The original shop at 317 Main Street in downtown Worcester, Massachusetts, and their second location out in Western Mass at 5 Market Street, Northampton. Both of these shops are loaded with both new and used vinyl. It's hard to walk in either shop and walk out empty-handed due to their amazing collection of records and other cool goodies like t-shirts, mugs, posters, etc. If you can't find what you're looking for in the retail stores, check out their website, joesalbums.com. Thank you, Joe, for being so cool. And we're back. You know, we often talk about the great history of Boston rock on this show, and I never for one minute take it for granted that I've been able to see so many great bands from in and around Boston over the years. Even when I lived in other cities, it was always great coming back here for shows, whether it be The Rat, The Channel, Storyville, TT the Bears, The Linwood, O'Brien's, The Abbey Lounge, Spit, Metro, Mamakin, Bill's Bar, Club Bohemia, the Middle East. So many good venues, so many exceptional bands. I'll never forget the first time I went to The Rat back in 1980 when I was a youngster to see The Outlets. It was love at first sight, not just for the club, but also for the band. I have been pretty lucky over the years, having lived in both Los Angeles and New York City for extended periods of time, seeing tons of shows in both those cities, plus all the touring I was able to do in the 80s and 90s with bands when I worked for labels. Even though Boston was always at the top of my list, many cities have or have had, I should say, first-rate venues across the states. Around 1987, 88, I was at CBGB Hardcore Matinee on the Lower East Side of Manhattan just about every single Sunday afternoon. I saw some incredible bands there regularly. New York City also had the Ritz, the Limelight, the Pyramid. It's a long list. Always fun to go out in New York City. LA as well had tons of options. It was always delightful to go to the Whiskey, the Roxy, the Troubadour, the Country Club in Reseda. But I got to say, I think Club Lingerie was my favorite when it comes to Hollywood. You never know who would be standing next to you at that place. At a Del Fuego show in 1984, Joe Strummer, David Lee Roth, and Paul Westerberg were all hanging out and all accessible enough for me to shake hands with. All of them. It was one of my most incredible nights I've ever had out. Of course, the Del Fuegos were incredible too. Those were the days. Aside from all the hoopla, I always enjoyed seeing bands in other cities as well. Found myself at the Bottleneck in Lawrence, Kansas at least 3 times. Great venue. Chicago always had great rooms. Same with Cleveland. How about the 930 Club in D.C.? Liberty Lunch in Austin. I could go on and on. Yes, I know how lucky I was to see so many great clubs, go to so many great clubs and see so many great bands. Rock and roll. Hello, my fellow rock and roll fans. Please consider supporting this podcast for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/TwistedRico. Once again, that's patreon.com/TwistedRico. Keep the rock and roll alive. So as I mentioned earlier, Miss Lynn and Blowfish today, they know a little bit about clubs and bands. They have been covering the Boston music scene since the mid-70s, and they have a fantastic website, bostongroupienews.com, where you can read interviews, find reviews, see great photos and club listings. It's probably the best place to get info on what's happening in Boston. And to top it off, it's run by some really nice people who love music just like we do. Buckle up, folks, because here I am with Miss Lynn and Blowfish from Boston Groupie News. Welcome to those of you watching on YouTube. This is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. If you want to hear this entire show with intros, outros, and music, please go to Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, etc. Please welcome to the show from Boston Groupie News, Miss Lynn and Blowfish. Wow.
Hello, people.
Wow. You know, I interview musicians all the time and I really get nervous, but I'm nervous interviewing you guys because you've interviewed everybody.
Well, we've been through it all. We've, you know, thinking about this interview just made me realize how long it's been on the scene since I met her in 1975.
Wow. I want to hear all about the whole story behind Boston Groupie News, but I was hoping that you both could tell me where you're from. Like, where did you guys grow up? What neighborhoods? Miss Lynn, do you want to go first? Or
I grew up in Holliston, which is, you know, maybe like a 20-minute drive. Just it's by Hopkinton where the marathon starts. And that's where I grew up. And
Mark Bell came from there.
Yeah, Mark Bell was also from Holliston.
I bet you guys.
That's how I got the intro into, you know, New York Dolls, T-Rex, like that, from Mark.
I get the feeling that you could probably tell me where every musician is from.
Yeah. We've met a lot of them.
I went to Framingham State, so I know Holliston.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Kenny Hyland and I don't know if you realize that I was married to Kenny.
Yes.
We got married at the church right there in Framingham Center. There's a church across the way from Framingham State.
And then later she got married on Oedipus's Demi Moan show, and I was the priest, Dr. Willie B. Felt. And that was a crazy day. But I got from Brighton originally. Born in Boston, raised in Brighton, then West Roxbury, and now I'm in Holbrook, Mass.
Holbrook?
Yeah, south of Braintree, north of Brockton. Very small.
Wow.
Yeah.
Miss Lynn, did you listen to a lot of music before you actually went to that New York Doll show that you write about? That you wrote about? I mean, we could talk about that in a minute, but did you get into like a lot of classic rock before the punk scene started?
I mean, we were talking about that. My first album I bought was with my own money that I chose to buy was The Monkees. And I mean, I remember listening to Beatles 45s when I was a kid. But then I think the thing I remember the most was like, you know, hippie music when I was in high school, you know, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, stuff like that. Then I met Mark and he turned me on to T-Rex, New York Dolls, things I hadn't heard before. And he was in bands early on. So he was playing, you know, different kind of live music. And that really sort of put me in the right direction.
You're talking about Cowboy Mark Bell?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Mark's been on the show 3 times, actually.
And you have a Mark Cowboy Award.
Yes, I did win a Cowboy Award. I wasn't nominated this year, but I was nominated 2 years in a row, so my feelings aren't hurt.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
So you didn't really dig that, the West Coast hippie stuff I'm taking. You didn't like it?
Oh, I did. I loved it, but I just grew out of it. I think, you know, it's that kind of thing you hear a lot of people say, you know, like when I saw the New York Dolls, I was like, I found my home. You know, it, I found what I was really into. And then when the punk stuff started coming along, it's like I found where I belonged.
Paul, did you get into a lot of music when you were a teenager?
Oh, we were talking about this earlier too. Before a teenager, when I was born in 1950, I can remember people talking about Elvis being on Ed Sullivan in 1956. I was listening to rock music soon after that and had a pile of records my aunt gave me in 1958.
Wow.
And yeah, and in those records, I had a whole pile of records. One was Buddy Holly, Not Fade Away, but there was a record called Buzz, Buzz, Buzz by the Hollywood Flames. I loved that record. 20 years later, I saw it on Jonathan Richman's floor. It was strewn on the floor. And he covered it on his album, Back in Your Life. And yeah. I told him, I know that record. And I sang him in my fashion, the song, you know, the lyrics, I knew them. And looking back, he must have really been impressed because nobody to this day knows that song. It was obscure in 1958. So anyways, I was listening to music back in the 50s. The first record I bought was Twist Twist Sonora by Gary U.S. Bonds.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I was listening to music, Fabian, Bobby Rydell, all through the 60s. First concert I saw was the Rolling Stones at the Boston Garden.
Wow.
You know, I didn't care about, well, I did care about the Rolling Stones, but I really cared about the openers, the Rockin' Ramrods. And my wow. favorite song at the time was Bright Lit Blue Skies. And I can remember right today, the sound of the guitars. They were fabulous. They were in white jumpsuits, whole complete white jumpsuits with black boots.
What year was that that you saw the Stones at the Garden?
It was 1965.
Early on, Brian Jones. Wow. Yeah.
And that's when I bought a guitar. The Beatles made me want to buy a guitar, but I didn't start listening. A lot of people started listening to music with the Beatles, but I was there 10 years early. You know.
That's fantastic. Yeah, you got me beat by a few years.
I had a guitar and I was in bands all the way through the 60s, up until punk and including punk.
Paul was just telling me about how he used to be a dance maniac, and he would go, his introduction to bands was going to local
CYO dances.
Yeah, CYO dances. And he won a dance contest for his twist at one point.
Yeah. I could twist, I could go down on one leg. And that got me an award.
That's impressive. The bio on the BGN page is absolutely fantastic. I went and reread. I remember the first time I read it, I was like, wow, the graphic, you know, first line. And then I went back and read it again. Could you tell my listeners, Lynn, in your own story, how this, that hall went down, where you went to see the Dolls and you became a groupie, I guess, right?
Well, that mindset certainly sort of set in at that point. I think it's just women. That's sort of the position they had back then. Anyway, I don't remember how I found out, probably through Mark, but I went with my friend Pam Green to this club in Ashland. I can't remember the name of it right now, but anyway, it was the New York Dolls and Ready Teddy. And I was, you know, Ready Teddy were great. We were blown away by them, but the New York Dolls were fantastic. And yes, you know, what's his name?
The Joe lead singer.
David Johansen was wearing this pink jersey suit coat and bell bottoms, and he wasn't wearing any underwear, and I could totally see everything. And I was, you know, I was totally inexperienced at the time. I was just like, whoa. And but they, you know, they were great. Johnny Thunders throwing himself around with the big hair and everything, and the music was just fantastic. And I've never seen anything like that ever before. You know, Mark Bell was in bands, Biggie Rat, and bands like that, but was nothing like the New York Dolls. So that was just really exciting. And so then we sort of chatted up Ready Teddy afterwards, and they said, yeah, well, you can come visit us at our house in Brookline. And when you come, bring some food, but don't bring spaghetti. Because we eat that all the time. Yeah. So we started going, hanging out at the, they had this, like, they rented this big house where they all lived in Brookline. We started going and hanging out there. And then, you know, that's where I met Willie, and then Willie Alexander. And then from there, I met this woman who said, oh yeah, Willie's bus stop is right across the street from my apartment in Harvard Square. You can move in with me. I was like, okay. So I moved into Harvard Square and started going to the Rat, especially on Monday nights, because Willie was playing with the Mez at that time. And he would play every Monday night with them. And so that was my introduction to the Rat and that music and everything.
It's interesting how back in the old days, I'm even talking about the 80s and maybe even 90s, bands used to always live together, but you don't hear about that much anymore. You'd have a bunch of guys in a house, you know, and you'd go there and the place would be a disaster. But, you know, that's yeah. what that's what they did back then. And it's just yeah. Now they stay home.
Now it's they don't do that. You're right. I never thought of that.
Yeah. Well, I think now it seems like people, you know, but I think maybe some of the younger kids do that. I know, you know, one of my favorite bands that's not around anymore that I keep talking about, Denzel.
Denzel, yeah.
D-N-Z-L. They were living in a house together. Before.
Yeah, with another group, too. There was like two groups in that house.
Yeah.
So that was recent. So. Yeah. So it does happen, but not like in the old days. It was a thing, yeah.
Yeah, well, they couldn't afford their own places, so...
That's true.
So you started the magazine, you put one issue out.
Well, no. So the truth behind the whole thing is that an issue of this thing called the Boston Group, you know, showed up.
Oh.
And, yeah, it was a single page, one-sided, and it was like trashing everyone that was in the scene at that time. And just saying, you know, nasty things about everyone. And so everyone was like, who, you know, who wrote this? Who wrote this? Who wrote this? Nobody knew. And, you know, really suggested you should just do another issue because everyone thinks it's you. Because I was hanging out with all those people. And so I started doing it anonymously for a few months, and it turns out later on, much later on, we find out it was John Macy, who is now in Hummingbird Syndicate, and was at that time was in Fox Pass. He and his girlfriend did it, and they thought, you know, obviously they thought it was like a one-time thing that would be funny, but it trashed so many people that I think it just made a bigger splash than John had ever expected. And everybody was kind of waiting for another issue. So, you know, like I always say, I would do anything at that point to impress Willie. So I was like, okay, I'll do it. So I had had some, when I was going to high school in Holliston, you could major in a subject. So I was majoring in art and we had an excellent art department and they, we tried graphic design. We tried all kinds of different things. So I actually had some experience with graphic design. And in Harvard Square, there was a Charette store. Charette did those press-on letters and stuff.
Right.
And all kinds of graphic design. They had graphic design materials. So I used to go there, buy the stuff, and I did my first issue.
Yeah. I just want to say the origin of it. It gets more confusing because John Macy did that first issue. And why did he do it? Because he wanted to get like, there was a scene and he wanted like a magazine for the scene. And who told him to do the newsletter? Well, he flew it to Willie. So Willie knew that John did it. And at the same time, told her to do the second issue. Yeah. And it's in the, because you look at our, we have an interview with John Macy in the BGN 40 years later, where he talks about that. Yeah.
Box You're pass. Saying,
Willie Alexander is evil.
It all begins with Willie.
I've heard the name Fox Pass. Were they one of the early rat bands?
Oh my God. Well, yeah. Well, rat? You know, they weren't on Live at the Rat, to his dismay. But they were one of the first early bands. I don't know whether you'd call them a rat band.
Well, you know, like you had Thunder Train and DMZ and all those bands. Yeah, were they part of that whole scene?
They were. I would, in fact, say they were almost, they were before Thunder Train and DMZ.
Yeah. If you now we go back to, our story is different than a lot of people's because we were in place before the word punk was used. We were on the scene. There were groups. The word punk wasn't used. It came up pretty fast, but the groups were playing before. And what groups? The original, maybe the first group was Ready Teddy. It was Fox Pass, Third Rail.
Third Rail, Richard Nolan, right.
And The Boys, B-O-I-Z-E. And there's maybe a few more, DMZ. Those were the first initial bands that were out there. And then the sort of the word punk worked its way in. But we're talking about 1974, 75.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how early that this was, what we're talking about is happening. The first Boston Groupie News came out in December of 1975.
So before I ask you about all these bands, because I want to know more about this, how did you two connect with each other?
You know, I feel bad for you, Steve, because everything is a big story.
I like stories. That's what this podcast is all. By the way, let me just thank you guys for constantly mentioning my podcast every week. I mean, thank you. I meant to say that at the beginning.
If I don't mention it, it's because you haven't interviewed a local person.
I understand that. Yeah.
That's another story about how during COVID I sort of found you, even though you started just before COVID started. But there was a whole different scenario. I paid attention to podcasts because of COVID, because I wasn't going out to the shows. But anyways, I was talking about how I met Miss Lynn.
Yes.
So this goes to my story, which is I'm on the scene. I'm going looking at all these groups, you know, Ready Teddy, and they're going to the Rat and the club in Cambridge. And the scene is starting, you know, and Oedipus is now on the radio. He had a show called Nuit Blanche, which was on Sundays. He moved it to Saturdays, called it the Demi Monde.
That's when it was super early in the morning.
It was super early in a Sunday morning. It was crazy. And anyways, the whole punk is gaining a little bit of a toehold here. And the whole idea of that scene at that time was get involved. It was do it yourself. We knew nobody in the real world cared about what was going on. No real musician, no recording studio label cared about the real kids. Oh, I didn't mention the real kids.
Oh, yeah.
And all that was going on. We knew that. So it was do it yourself and get involved. So what was I going to do? I wanted to get involved. So I could play guitar, but I didn't know any of the musicians around. I had played in bands, but I didn't feel like I could get in there and do that. So I had a tape recorder. So there was this guy called Michael Fremmer. He was a comedian. I'm not going to go into his whole thing, but he just did parodies of musical acts and did advertisements for record stores like New England Music City. So I took him as a model and I started doing comedy bits, which I sent to Oedipus. Oedipus did not play them. They were pretty bad. I kept sending them week after week. After about 5 or 6 weeks, he finally played one.
He was at this is still BCN, right? He's already this is before BCN?
TBS.
WTBS, which is now
BU, right?
MIT. You probably don't know it. WMBR, the Late Risers Club, before that, it was called WTBS.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
Ted Turner bought the rights to the whatever you call those, the call letters.
Because it was the Turner Broadcasting System.
Oh, yeah. So
they paid him like $35,000 for that. So they changed it to WMBR, which is the Walker Memorial Building. Walker Memorial Radio.
I never would have known that. Ever.
See, that's something that was lost from back in the day. So Oedipus was on the MIT station. And, you know, at that time, and that's another story, we talk about that. I talk about that in the film. There's a film about the Late Risers Club.
Oh, I have to see that.
Yeah, it's on YouTube if you get in two parts. But what was I going to say?
Oh, how did we meet? Anyway. Okay.
This is getting complicated. So I was sending him things. So I was sort of the in-house comedian. That's the way I considered myself.
Yeah.
I was a comedian. That's what I was saying. So I was parodying and, you know, doing satire things. So I was getting the BGN. You could get it through the mail back then.
You could subscribe.
So I did a parody of the BGN, the Boston Groupie News, called The No Good Groupie News. Now, meanwhile,
it was hilarious.
There's only been like about 5 or 6 issues out. It wasn't a heck of a lot there, but I typed up a page, both sides, making fun of the Groupie News.
Wow.
So it was just me, right? And so I used to take pictures with my Instamatic, and they weren't the best pictures. And I used to type out the text of the BGN in some crappy typewriter, and I didn't know how to, never took typing lessons. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there were a lot of mistakes and the pictures were bad, which set him up for some really good parodies.
Which is funny stuff. And we always talk about the picture. She used to take it. She had a famous Instamatic. The pictures were so bad, and she would do it on the Xerox machine. So the pictures, you couldn't see them. They were just like a square. So in the No Good Groupie News, I put a black square.
Completely.
And right. I said, this is a picture of Willie Loco's uvula. But it's crazy shit like that.
That's great, man. What a way to start a relationship, though, you know? That's fantastic.
I wasn't doing it anonymously at the time still, right?
No. Your name was on the top. Okay.
So I did it anonymously for quite a while. And I would sneak out like in the afternoon, 3 o'clock, and go to the clubs, the Rat and the Club and Cantons, and put the BGN on the cigarette machines. Talk about, you know, different time, right?
Yeah.
And then go out to the club at night and watch people like fanatically reading the thing instead of watching the bands. But anyway, so I get this thing in the mail. I thought it was so great. And I really wanted to... change what the BGN was doing. I didn't want it to be like this trashy thing, insulting people. And I wanted more. And so we met, and I appreciated his humor and the parody that he was doing. And we met and we talked about it. And it just was a great match because he had so much to bring with his comedic sense and stuff like that.
And when we started, you know, it was just a couple of pages and it was basically print and it was nothing much there. It was gossip, you know. And after we started, she would say, we're going to do an interview. I go, well, we can't do an interview, you know, it's rag, you know. And then she said, we're going to have a cover page, a cover photo. A cover photo? No, I couldn't imagine what she was thinking of. I had no ambitions, zero. That was all her. What the BGN became was all in her head. It wasn't in mine. I was just sort of following along and feeding it, you know?
What was the reception? I'm sorry. What was the reception you were getting from bands about this in the early days?
Well, bands, you know, we talked to bands a lot through the years. A lot of bands, that was their goal, to get in the Groupie News.
Nice.
Yeah, that was it. They used to tell us, you know, we got this band together, blah, blah. we were hoping to get in the group of news. That was their reason. That was like something to shoot for. But I was going to say, I lost my thought there.
Oh.
But they always loved it. They always wanted to be interviewed. They always wanted to be the next interview. They would talk to us about that interview, us. They wanted to be reviewed in it.
Do you remember the first interview that you did?
Oh, yeah.
Was it really?
No, it was Matthew McKenzie.
Oh, yes. It was a special edition.
Matthew of Ready Teddy.
Okay, Ready Teddy, right.
We went to their house, their band house that she was talking about in Brookline. And it was crazy. It was this big Victorian. We went into the room, Matthew's room, no bed, just mattress on the floor. And we had a great interview. And I'm very proud of that interview because if you read it today, you can hear Matthew's voice and what he was. And he's dead now. He passed on. He died of a complication from drugs, probably in the early 80s.
Well, he was in a car accident. He had a heart attack while he was in a coma.
Yeah.
But he was doing drugs.
But yeah, I think that was involved there somehow. But I'm very proud of the fact that you read it, you could hear his voice and you know what sort of a person he was and his interests. It was a great interview, I thought.
And I think one thing I've learned over the years was that Paul is really great coming up with questions for the interviews.
Yeah.
Like for example, this interview, right? He's been preparing for days and I'm like, okay, whatever, you know? And so for interviews with bands, he would do the same thing. He would prepare, he would think about it, you know, and
his notes.
Well, you know what? You know what's really funny is I have the least amount of questions for you guys that I ever had because I knew we'd be 28 minutes into it like we are now, and you guys are just filling in all the blanks for me. So thank you. Tell me about some of the bands that you were seeing. We mentioned a few of them already. I know you obviously love Willie because you keep mentioning him. You mentioned The Real Kid. What about Jonathan Richman?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, now that's a whole other thing.
But Jonathan Richman,
he wasn't on the scene playing.
Yeah, wasn't on the scene.
No, he was not in those clubs. He did play Cantones once. Once that I know of.
Wow.
And he was on the floor singing I'm a little dinosaur. Yeah. But he wasn't as part of that coterie of groups that were there in that initial period.
He gets bunched in all the time with, you know, the Real Kids and DMZ.
He
had the Modern Lovers before all of this was going on. And John Felice was in the band. David Robinson was in the band. And the keyboard player who went on to...
Jerry Harrison.
Yeah, he was in the band. So I think he influenced a lot of people, people that came immediately after, but he wasn't hanging around the scene.
Yeah. But the bands, I was going to say, don't forget the neighborhoods. I want to talk. Does Third Rail was very big at the time.
We can never forget the neighborhoods.
Forget the neighborhoods. The Third Rail was, they had such great songs. And even now, if you go back, if you can get what you can, those Third Rail songs were really great. I mean, hooks and it's just what, and Richard had a couple of talents. Singing was one, writing songs was another, and picking band members was not the third.
I thought you were going to say picking up band members for a minute.
Well, he did that too.
Well, yeah.
I met Richard Nolan. I know. I interviewed him on college radio in 1981. I remember him very well.
And so he had a whole list of bands. You know, I mean, series of bands, they were all fantastic. And Fox Pass was another one I saw a million times, who has sort of forgotten today a little bit because they don't have a lot of recorded history. But they were high on the list.
And the boys were Rick Caracciolo, who
Liars.
And Billy Connors.
And Billy Connors, who is still playing around now.
But I want to say that the neighborhoods, they were sort of roadies for Third Rail there at the very beginning.
Wow.
And they were actually considered to us a later band.
They were the second wave. They weren't in that first edition, but they were there, and they did become a group eventually. And we saw them. They would open for Third Rail. And people would say, you know, they're not too bad, huh? Gee, they were pretty good. And, you know, begrudgingly saying this new band, and they were so young. I said, gee, they're pretty good. Then the next time, you know, those songs are really great. And the third time, heck, this is the greatest. This group is fantastic. And they really rapidly, you know, became a favorite band. And I can remember the first time they played out of town. They played in town. They played in Boston at Cantones, because up to that point, they'd only played in Cambridge, you know.
I remember I was friends with Richard. So I remember, I think I was on Calm Ave somewhere, and I was hanging out with the neighborhoods. And one of them asked me, was it David Minahan? I don't even know if there are any pictures of them with long hair. But anyway, David's like, Miss Lynn, what should we do? You know, so people will like us more. And I said, cut your hair. Because David had long hair. So he did cut his hair and changed his look and everything. I remember that.
Were you two, by the way, at the famous Rumble show with La Peste and the Neighborhoods?
The what show?
The Rumble.
Oh.
No. No, I was not at that one. As a matter of fact, I was in the one before that, which was
the unofficial first
the one. Unofficial one in the Inman Square Bar. And who won that one? That one,
I think La Peste won that the first one, and then they won again. It's really funny. I always tell people when we're in the S&S Deli, there used to be a bar in here, a famous club. I never went there. I was too young, but. You wouldn't think that neighborhood would have a rock club like that, you know?
No, that was a cool place, small, very small and uncomfortable.
It was sort of like triangular shaped almost, right? That's kind of what kind of
it was long. It was not set up right. And the band, it was long and skinny. So, but the band was faced, you know, on the long side. So it was weird. It was a weird time.
What was it like at the end of the 70s when all of a sudden this new group of bands started coming along, like more garage, you know, even more punkier and garage bands? What was the scene like in like the late 70s?
Well, I think the thing for me was we would get, you know, the Rat gained notoriety, and then I guess maybe the album came out, you're better than I am on chronological.
Well, I'm trying to think of that time period.
We had a lot of bands from other towns coming in, which was really great because we got to meet, you know.
Things really ramped up and they were really popping at the end of the 70s, really cranking. And local acts, we were just like drowning in them. Yeah, they were coming left and right. It was fantastic. What can I tell you? That was the greatest period. Do you know, a lot of people showed up in Boston at like 81, 82, 83, whatever. I hear a lot of people say that. And I'm thinking, okay, but you missed that 70s. They were fantastic. We were going and seeing groups. I mean, all the groups, it's just mind numbing. Our second wave, which would be Unnatural Acts and La Peste.
Oh, yeah.
And Liars, but they were DMZ. I mean, those were such great groups. Thrills with Barb Kitson. I mean, it was amazing. It was living the life. What can you say?
And I had, luckily for me, I had a job working the concession stands at in the subway. And this company was notorious for firing people for false reasons to get them out of the system so they wouldn't have to pay health coverage and all this stuff. So they fired me for stealing, which I never did. And I never have stolen anything. I mean, and I was so upset. But anyway, I was able to collect unemployment. So I could go out every night. I was going out every night of the week.
Yeah.
I I didn't make it to the Rat till around 80. I think the first show I saw was the Outlets. They played on New Year's Day. It was funny because back then you guys mentioned Monday nights for the big night. Things have changed. I mean, back then you could go out every night of the week, but people don't do that anymore. Well, they stopped doing that, I'd say, as time went on. There was a, I remember, you know, around 81, I think it was, Storyville and the Rat used to be able to go back and forth. That's how I got my introduction and the channel, of course. Did you see a lot of, I know you know the Prime Movers, Lynn, because I know you're friends with Cam. And that wave of bands there was the Prime Movers and the Neats, and you mentioned the Outlets, and you mentioned the Neighborhoods. And then Rick started up Ace of Hearts. What was that period like? That's when it got really exciting and a lot of bands started getting signed.
Yeah. Oh, you know, we've seen that whole arc from the beginning where we were hated. You know, punk was hated. No one wanted anything to do with us. Record companies were running away. That was the initial thing. Slowly gaining some traction, having a lot of fun. And then things got serious. Once we got to the Neats period, then the record label started coming in and things were getting, what would you say? There was competition more, things were ramped up. People were more serious. It wasn't as much fun maybe as it was. It's getting a little more serious. Hmm. People, they could smell a record contract, but the music was fantastic. And I was on the radio at the time, you know, on the Late Risers Club. And I mean, the records are pouring. That was the greatest time to be on the radio. And you were on the radio at that time, too. I mean, it was unending. I don't think we've seen anything more like it. To me, those were less just like the best days.
Yeah. And for me, after Harvard Square, then I got married and I moved. But when I came back in the 80s, I lived in Alston, and Cam actually lived like two blocks away from me on Linden Street, I think it was called, that infamous street in Alston. And on the other side, one block away from me, was Johnny D's, the original Johnny D's in Alston, not the one in Somerville. And I was going to Mass Art at the time, and a bunch of us used to hang out at Johnny D's. And this guy who worked in the kitchen asked us, what do you think about having bands here? And we were like, yeah, that would be great. So we started having bands. And Alston was like huge. Everybody lived in Alston, just about, you know. So it was like everyone lived there. Everyone was hanging out there. And I remember Talia Zedek was in the neighborhood. A lot of people just lived around that neighborhood. And so it was a great social time, great community feeling too.
I mean, live through that was just so, and to be in Alston area and Kenmore Square, it was just,
people used to hang out fantastic. During the day.
It was a wonderful thing. Yeah. If you walked through Kenmore Square, you'd see somebody, you know.
Well, then you ran into the Dogmatics.
Dogmatics? Yeah. We were.
We're going to talk about the Dogmatics. Don't worry.
So we were in. The great thing is we used to hang out all the time. You know, I was off work like Wednesdays. I used to do the Late Risers Club in the morning. And then I'd meet Lynn, we'd go eat, and we would do some Boston Groupie News, whatever we have to do, you know? And so one time we were out there, we had done an interview or something. We're in Kenmore Square. It's in March. It's dark. It's at night. We were eating at that Super Salad or something there. We come out and walking by are the Dogmatics with the guitar, and they were going to like a party for St. Patrick's Day. They're going to play at a party. They had a stand-up bass, and they stopped in Kenmore Square, opened up the guitar case. They started playing like they're busking. So I had my camera with me. I take these pictures. They're just fantastic. They were jumping around, and it was cold that night, but you know, I got these fantastic pictures. They always remember that day. And it was just one of these moments that would have happened because you're in Kenmore Square and there's bands every other you know, doorway, there's a band, you know, they're eating at the pizza pad, you know.
I'm sure you realize that you have one of the great scenes in the Dogmatics documentary, the motor. How did you manage not to get run over by the motorcycle? That's what I want to know.
Well, you saw how I was jumping around like a jackrabbit because I knew it. This was the most stupidest thing I ever did. I knew it then. I knew it was stupid, and I'd never do anything more stupid than that. It was ridiculous. And you know what's funny in that scene? It looks crazy. You can't smell it.
I was just thinking
Ooh,
that.
Ooh, yeah.
You could almost gag after that when that was going on because of the gas fumes. With two motorcycles in an enclosed space, it was crazy. I got to tell you, you know, people talk about these crazy times that have happened. There's the photo proof right there.
Oh, I mean, I don't know if you saw the, excuse me, the episode I had, and Jerry told the whole story about how he had the tape the whole time, and then he found it and played it, and that was all on the tape. And you stole the scene. You were the scene stealer in the documentary, Paul.
Well, I was waiting for 40 years to see that. They taped that. It was never completed. I never saw the raw footage. I never knew those people. I know Joyce Linehan was involved. If I saw her, I would have asked her about where's the film, but I never did see her after that. But I've been waiting 40 years to see that. And I was very happy because I thought I did well. And they cut out. There was more of that in the original cut of the film. And it was more of me in there. And I liked the way I looked, and I had a way with the camera. And I thought, if I had seen that back in the day, I might have, you know, pursued the video thing a little bit more.
Become a movie star.
Yeah, your whole spiel about urban renewal and all that, it was fantastic. I mean, you go to Fair Street now, and it's unrecognizable from what it was back then.
No, oh, yeah. And I did that recently. I went back about 2 or 3 years ago. Actually, probably 4 years ago, and it is way different. I was going to say something with the that whole thing. Oh yeah, I used to do that Lifestyles of the Pure and of the Poor and Unknown. I did it on the radio. I did it with Wayne Fiennes. I did like Michael Cudahy and a few other people, and so they heard that. They were doing this video. They were going to do a pilot for a morning talk show. It was going to be Joyce Linehan. They had a sectional couch, and we had these different features. They were going to have a group of the group of the week, and that group for the pilot was the Smithereens.
Oh.
And
I saw them.
And they got me to do my bit.
And you were supposed to be like, what was his name?
Robin Leach. Yeah. And I was a Robin, really big Leach. And I had the white suit on because he was always in these tropical paradises, these tropical hideaways, in the white suit. So that's why I had the white suit in that. Thing.
I wanted to bring something up before I forget. Miss Lynn mentioned Talia Zedek. The whole art, I call it the art scene. It was like Dangerous Birds, November Group, Christmas, V. Were you guys into that scene? Because I thought that was a really cool scene. Mission of Burma seemed to be the ones that brought the art and the hardcore scene together. What was that like? What do you recall from that group, that era?
Yeah, and you know, the Neats was sort of part of that arty thing too, even though they sort of don't sound as arty maybe as the other ones, but they were on the verge. With
Propeller. They were on the Propeller label too, right? Yeah, they started there.
666, that's like a conceptual song, you know, and that's it. But they were great. Matter of fact, where they used to play the most was at the Underground, which was a fabulous club.
Yeah.
Which was at the corner of Commonwealth Ave, right?
Yeah, it's that Packard's Corner where ComAb makes that big turn.
Really? I never went there.
Oh my God. But and the Cure played there famously.
Wow, really?
Yeah, the Cure played there. And I saw a lot of groups there, but it was a fabulous place. But a lot of the art groups played there.
Yes.
And it was I have to hand it to those people, especially because to me, that music held up. If you go back, it is interesting. it was less musical or melodical, you know, but the conceptual part of it was more than made up for that. It was very interesting. Native tongue.
Yeah, those native guys, tongue. Limbo yeah. race. Limbo race.
Oh my God, limbo race. Don't get me going. Limbo race.
I loved, by the way, I was a huge Dangerous Birds fan. I went to see them every chance I could. When you mentioned Talia, she's one of my absolute favorites. She's just.
You know, they sort of had two different sounds of Dangerous Birds.
Yeah.
And they had that woman, I can't remember, I think her name was
Lori Green.
Green.
I didn't like her songs. I liked Talia's songs. I thought her sound sound was really good.
Sorry, Lori.
Yeah.
We were going to interview them and they broke up just right at that point.
Wow. Yeah, I used to see them at Storyville a lot. Storyville had a lot of those bands we're talking about now.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did. A lot of people forget about Storyville. That was a great place too. That was an old jazz club.
Yeah.
So it looked cool, you know.
What is it, Pizza Hut or something now?
Yeah, I don't even know. The last time I went to Kenmore Square, 20 years ago, I don't know.
I'm going to fast forward here to 2002, because I think that's when I read that you guys went to the internet. Was it easy to pick up readers when you did that? Because now I know you're very popular. But we're talking about 22 years ago now. What was it like then?
Well, that was like the early days of the internet when I look back now. Do you know, when we went on the internet in 2002, there were about three or four sites that dealt with the Boston scene. One was called Dirty Water. Another one was called New England Music Scrapbook, NEMS. And there was that one from Joe Harvard had that rock and roll, Boston rock and roll site. And within a few years, they were all gone, except for the Joe Harvard site, which was not, he never added to that. But we've been around since those days. It seems crazy. When we first put up just a page and said, we're the Boston Groupie News. We used to be around. Do you remember us? And there was sort of a cascade of people that came out. Yeah, we remember you, blah, blah, blah. What are you going to do? What are you, blah, blah, blah. What are you going to, what's your plans? Whatever. You know, we had X amount of interest.
But I was clueless. I mean, I think we didn't really know what was going on so much. If you look at those very, very early pages, they're very, just like the evolution of the original BGN, you know, it changed over time. And it was sort of, you know, the early web pages are, you know, very short, not much information.
And of course, when we went on, we did just have the one page. We didn't have anything else. We just had a splash page. And so what we started to do is put the old content in. So we would put the old in. And that's what we started. And the more we filled in, the more people we got. And it did slowly build. We always had, I don't know, I can remember seeing 500, 1,000 people over how long a period, I don't know, like within a week or something like that. It started growing. The more content we put in, the more people came on, you know, came to visit us.
And it seemed like there was kind of a synchronicity to it also, because after a while, you know, these bands that we were originally covered were getting back together and playing also.
Yeah.
So it was wild.
Then we started putting in new content. We started going out, you know, and putting what we were going on anyways here and there, but putting that content, getting pictures and putting them online. And so it was a learning process for us, but, you know, it was a very slow. And right now we have about, during COVID, we had 30,000 people a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
30,000
logins. Yes. Logins. So that's either one person logging in 30,000 times or 30,000 people logging in once. But, you know, we get about 1,000 people a week.
That's onto great.
Our main page, the main page and news page.
You know? Are you guys surprised at all by the lasting? First of all, there's two bands. There's these bands that last forever and they're still around. And then there's the revival. Are you guys surprised that so many of those bands are still around or have revived themselves in one way or the other?
Well, I don't know what you mean about revival. Ones you mean bands
like
that
the like the Dogmatics are a good example. They were gone for a long time, and now they're like one of the most popular bands in town. And then even if you want to just say 20 years or so, the Muck and the Myers, they're more popular now than they ever were. And they and Evan's been doing this since the 80s, you know? That's what I mean by that.
Yes. And I was just going to say, I would spotlight the Nerve Zetas on that. And
there you go.
Amazed. I'm not amazed that they're still playing, because some people are born to play and want to be in front of an audience. I'm amazed they're so good. I'm amazed, like you had said, that the Dogmatics' new material is just as good or better than their old material. The same with the Nervous Eaters. The Nervous Eaters are a stinking machine pumping out songs and performances, recordings, and videos. 2024. I mean,
it's incredible.
I'm completely amazed. And I was thinking Richie Parsons, he just came out with his punk EP.
Those two solo records he did that came out a few years ago are fantastic.
And I love that. I love those records because that's a way for him to go forward with his career. Sorry. He's just not a punk guy. He can now play with this other group and he has a whole other thing going.
Do you want some water?
Yeah.
do you remember when Richie I'm glad you brought up Richie because I wanted to talk about him because he always talks about the famous Runaways show at the Rat. He's the one that first brought it up. And when I had him on my show, I was blown away. The stories he told me about how Bowie and Iggy Pop and Debbie Harry all showed up at the Rat to see these teenage girls from California. Were you guys there by any chance?
I was outside trying to get in. I never could. There was a line down the block for that.
What was this for?
The Runaways. Did you go in that show?
At the Rat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were in there?
And Richie was only a teenager at that time. He snuck in or something?
Yeah, Richie was wild. He was so young. And yeah, he was at those early shows before they let him in the door. He wasn't old enough to be
carded. I have to tell this story because I haven't told it often. But I had my 50th birthday or something at the Abbey. And
Abbey Lounge.
I invited a certain amount of people to play. And Richie, I don't know if Unnatural Acts played. See, I don't have the best memory. But Richie got on stage and he told this story that I had never known about until that night. And he said that he used to take the red line to Filene's basement to his job. And I was there at Downtown Crossing at the concession stand, right? And I used to wear this jean jacket with the collar up and I had pins. I had a Tough Dart pin. And he saw me and he had like this wicked crush on me. And he said he started a band, the Unnatural Acts, because he wanted to like meet me and impress me.
Wow.
He told that story at the Abbey. I just got like chills. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, it's amazing because for me, it meant like, you know, you never know. You could just be walking down the street and smile at somebody and you don't know how it's going to affect someone. And just me feeling like a dork at a Subway concession stand, I impressed this guy who, you know, later...
He wrote a song about it.
Yeah, he's written a few songs. His wife said once to his daughter, Elizabeth, he's written more songs about Miss Lynn than he has about me.
We have a great picture of Richie in 1978. The EP, Unnatural Acts EP, had just come in that day. So he went to the show. I can't remember who's playing at Cantone's. He brought the record. And I have a picture of us outside Cantone's with Billy Tupper, Joanne Green, Rita Ratt, and Bob Kitson. We're holding the Unnatural Acts EP, 1978. Cool.
Wow.
Those are the days.
You guys, Well, before I ask you this question, let me ask you another one. What do you think of the scene right now? Where do you think about, I know we had the pandemic and that kind of put everyone on hold, but then I was telling someone last night that I saw that I think since the pandemic, all of a sudden the music scene has exploded. There's like shows every night, new records every day. I mean, what's your whole take on that?
Oh, yeah, it's as healthy as ever. And like you said, COVID was a little bump there, but it was so healthy before that. I mean, and like you say, right now, there's more clubs than ever when you count these breweries, especially, you know, Faces and Deep Cuts. I mean, wow, there's just more places to play than ever. There are, although I think there's some bands that haven't made the cut from COVID. Otherwise, there's a few bands I like that are not playing now. Since because they COVID disrupted them, you know, I think of Labor Hex was a group I really liked, and they're not there now. It did stop a few groups in mid-flight. There, Denzel was a group we used to go crazy for. That COVID sort of stopped them in their tracks. So there's a little bit of that. With that caveat, I would say things are pretty gangbusters.
Like, I imagine a lot of bands send you guys their information on shows and new records, because you guys, how can you never, there's always a ton of news every week, so someone must be reaching out to you.
Well, not as much as we don't. Want
they don't.
No,
I look up those gigs every week and I update it. We barely, there are, you count them on one hand, the bands that actually email me with their gigs.
Yeah.
And really? Same thing with CDs. And we're always like, what's wrong? Why don't they send us the stuff? And I just don't think they're into self-promotion like they should be or something. Yeah. Or they just don't know about us. I don't know.
I guess the reason I said that is because I see the Facebook reaction that you get. You know, there's a million people thanking you every week, you know?
Yeah. We get 1,000 views and up to 4,000 on our news, depending on what's in there. But yeah, people, bands are notoriously bad. Carmen, Carmelita of Bay State Rock, she always complains. The bands don't send me material, or they want me to pay for the material. They want me to pay for the band camp access, you know? Bands are not self-promoting enough.
That's really funny, because I always end up paying $1 for a song every other day, it seems, because I need songs for my show. So I can relate to Carmelita saying that.
Yeah. What we get a lot of, though, because the emails come to me. Yeah. So what we do get a lot of is
promos.
Promo companies, even promo companies like with big bands and, you know, folk, alt folk bands and all, delete. But...
Yeah. You find good stuff through them.
Yeah, and so, and I think during COVID that helped us, because we had a broader view of music that was out there that helped us talk about stuff. And we cover different stuff now than we did before. Yeah. Before it was us only going punk. Out and seeing bands and paying for the bands, never on the guest list, never invited by the bands. Yeah.
We've been on so few guest lists, you'd be so surprised.
And even bands that know we love them
they don't send us the stuff. Everything it's in, I spend my week scouring around looking for material.
And then I forward them stuff that I get that I think is, you know, BGN worthy.
I wanted to make the point about COVID that before COVID, I used to go out 3 nights a week, and that's the material was band reviews. I reviewed the live groups I saw that week, and boy, those reports were way long. But with COVID, I stopped going out because of COVID, and then we changed. The BGN changed at that point from a sort of a live band blog to sort of an aggregate news thing as you know it now. And like Lynn said, we changed our view from purely punk. We didn't go beyond our borders that much. Now we do, because of the situation we're in and how we can access material.
Okay, I'm not going to let you guys off this easy. I want you both to give me, and I'll give you a minute to think, your top three. I was going to say five, but I'll just keep it down to three. Your top three all-time favorite Boston bands.
Yeah. Well, I didn't even think about it. I'll give you three. Nervous Eaters, Real Kids, and Liars. And didn't I meet you going to a Liars show?
Yeah, if you did, we were. I was with Alvin Long. I was going to bring that up. And I saw Miss Lynn at a Mr. Airplane show. Was it? No, Mr. Airplane.
That was the Linkin Park, Johnny the Food Masters.
Yes, but she played.
Margaret played a solo with her solo band. Oh, that day, I think. Yeah, it wasn't Mr. Airplane, man. That was easy, Paul. I mean, come on, Liars, Nervous Eaters, and who's the third one?
Liars, Nervous Eaters, Real Kids.
You're going all the way back.
For me, I have not. Oh well, Willie Loco.
Yeah, Willie. For me, it's different because I think there's. I sort of compartmentalize the early bands and the later bands. I mean, you know, yeah, I totally love like the Boom Boom Band and Nervous Eaters and the Real Kids, but there are later bands that I love too, like Denzel that we're talking about, and Bloodstained Brindle, which doesn't play out often, but I love them, and the Marvels, who were around in the 90s, maybe.
I remember them.
All-time favorite bands.
They were great. Yeah,
I loved them so much.
But a lot of great bands. I just want to say my favorite bands right at this minute. The ones are Paper Tigers, Actor Observer, Oh the Humanity, and I have this listed. Today Junior, I think, is fabulous. And then the obvious ones like Chelsea Curve and Babes. And Sapling, I think it's fantastic. Did you have Sapling on?
They're on my list.
Yeah, you should. They are so interesting. I got their album and it was like, I wanted to review it and I couldn't because I needed like another week to really listen to it. There's so much going on in it. They're very talented.
Yeah, I'm very impressed by what's going on right now with new bands and new music and everything. Like, I'm on Bandcamp a lot looking for bands, and a lot of bands, like you said, I've got all those publicists writing me too, like I'm sure you imagine. And, you know, a lot of it, it's hard to say no, but I have so many people that want to come on the show that it's easy for me to get guests, you know? That's why I like doing it.
And yet, you're one of the people when I rewrite the story, I was thinking of writing a story or something or an article on COVID times and the people that got us through COVID times. And the one that comes to mind immediately is Linnea Herzog, because the first week I thought, what are we going to do? I can't go out to see a group. And that week, Linnea played a concert every week on video and from her bedroom. And then after that was that Doug McCormick, who did the art show. I thought that was fabulous. He did painting for an hour on the video. It's like, that's outrageous. And then the podcast cropped up. And you're one of those people that you had to show all the way through COVID and helped people like me, other people, get through that period. So, you know, you're part of that
Help
story.
Myself get through that period.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you guys so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. I knew it was going to be a fast moving conversation because you guys, I'm sure we missed things too, but we'll have to do it again.
Yeah.
We can be on again.
Yeah. I'd love to have you guys on again.
Repeater.
Thank you very much.
You're doing a fantastic job. I listen all the time, as you know. Because I give my little pricey and review during, you know,
thank
weekly.
Thank you. I really appreciate the plug, man, that you guys give my show. Really do. Thank you.
Oh, and I admire your persistence and consistency.
I'm trying.
Yeah.
You know, I just have to say that's one thing we've definitely learned about is there's a lot of people that cannot handle that kind of consistency.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. They fall by the wayside.
Yeah, we've, you know, So how long has it been? 2002.
Oh,
it's been 22 years.
Yeah.
Every Sunday, he and I are on our computers from like 8 in the morning till 4 p.m. at night, and we do the BGN. And we've had people like, oh, yeah, I want to review records for you. I want to do this column. They last, you know, 2-3 columns, 2-3 this yeah. and that submissions, and then they go away.
Can't do
and
it.
They can't yeah. handle that yeah. consistency, that yeah. whatever it takes.
Yeah.
They just don't have it.
It's, you know, it's the same thing with bands too. You know, lack of perseverance is what stopped so many great bands from becoming yeah. much bigger. And you could say that about some Boston bands. I mean,
you know, for me, yeah. I think to people, like, I invite people, can you start taking photos for us? And, you know, because you go out all the time, take photos and just write a little story. And then they say things like, oh, I don't think I could write. I can't yeah. write anything.
Yeah.
And I'm like, just start typing, you know, but anyone can do it. You just have to want to do it.
Yeah. And the other thing, other quality people like us have is self-motivation. You have to be self-motivated. There's nobody coming to us giving us money. We don't even get that any accolades that much. It's very low budget, low key. You have to be self-motivated.
But now we're in a museum yeah. and it's going to be a traveling show too.
Oh yeah.
We love, you know, we all have the same love, I think, for this. We love
Absolutely.
It. If you don't yeah. love it.
I mean, you know, that's the, what do they say? Labor of love. That's yeah. what this is. Yeah.
Thank you guys yeah. for doing what you do.
We'll see you out there.
All righty.
Baby.
the real kids. It's a small, small town. Seem to fit. Seem to fit. That song seemed to fit. That's why I played it. Thank you, Miss Lynn and Blowfish, for coming on the show. That was a real blast. Please check out Boston Groupie News if you haven't already. Fun site run by very cool and knowledgeable music people. They are, Miss Lynn and Blowfish. Cool people, too. All right, if you have any comments, questions, whatever, please feel free to drop me a line anytime at twistedrico@gmail.com. If you're a musician or a songwriter and you have music, please send it over. You might hear it on this show, or you might even hear it on our sister podcast, Mirror Stars. If you haven't checked out Mirror Stars yet and you want to get real geeky, check it out. You can find it on Apple and Spotify and wherever else you listen to podcasts. That's Mirror Stars, hosted by yours truly. We also have an Instagram page, Facebook, Threads, YouTube, where you can actually watch the Zoom interview I did with Miss Lynn and Blowfish. And there is also a TikTok page. It's at Twisted Rico, where you can watch clips from this show. Want to remind you that next week we have a very special show. Roger Miller from Mission of Burma. That's right. Roger Miller, guitarist, Mission of Burma, is on the show next week. All right. That's going to do it for this time. Till the next time we say goodbye, this is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. Keep the rock and roll alive.